Speaking personally, the Earl Russell. What follows is a selection made from Lord Russell's part in talks between himself and John Chandos, which took place on the 11th and 12th of April, 1961, at his house in North Wales. John Chandos speaks first.
The scene of our talks was Lord Russell's study. The climate was mildly cool. A fire burned on the hearth. The French windows stood open, overlooking a great panoramic view of Cardigan Bay. During the ensuing 2 days, climatic conditions varied from sunshine and blue skies to torrential rainfall, so that sometimes the background of sounds to our conversation were birdsong, the lowing of cattle, and the voices of my host's grandchildren at play in the garden. At other times, the gutters could be heard in flood above the veranda. At intervals, the sound of a railway train in motion and its warning whistle floated to us across the bay with uncanny clarity. Lord Russell began by talking of his early childhood, when he lived in the house of his paternal grandfather, Lord John Russell, the statesman who had perhaps averted a revolution and preserved the monarchy in early Victorian England by steering through Parliament the Great Reform Bill of 1832, 5 years before the accession to the throne of Queen Victoria.
Well, I was only 6 years old when my grandfather died, and I didn't, of course, know very much, really, about him. I have recollections of him as a very, very kindly old man. I used sometimes to play about all round when he was in the room, and never once did he suggest that I should make less noise. Well, since I've become a grandfather myself, I consider that a merit. And I have a vision of him always reading Hansard. We had a large hall in the house, and the hall was entirely lined with bookshelves containing Hansard, and he was always reading Hansard, to my recollection. The relationship between my grandfather and Queen Victoria was not very happy. You see, my grandfather and Palmerston were both of them champions of Italian unity, and Italian unity involved Austria giving up territory, and Austria in those days was counted as part of Germany, and the Prince Consort was a German, therefore, was against Italian unity, and consequently Queen Victoria was against it, and on this question they had some very acrimonious dealings with Queen Victoria. There's a story, I can't absolutely vouch for its truth, but there is a story that Queen Victoria said to him, "Lord John, do I understand that you think there are circumstances in which a subject may rightly resist the sovereign?" And my grandfather is said to have replied, "Speaking to a sovereign of the House of Hanover, I think I may say yes."
Bertrand Russell began to reveal his tastes and talents at an early age. Encouraged by his brother, the second Earl Russell, he embarked upon what was to be a lifelong love affair with mathematics before the age of puberty.
I remember them very well. Euclid was an intense delight to me. I was 11 years old, and I thought, this is lovely stuff. My brother was very pleased. I did the fifth proposition, which is called the Pons Asinorum, and I didn't find any difficulty about it at all, so he's awfully pleased. He was at Winchester and then at Balliol. He was sent down from Balliol, and I never discovered exactly why. It was said by Jowett to be because he had written an improper letter to a married woman, but I think it really was because he was too fond of Lionel Johnson. He was a poet, a young poet, and certainly my brother had a great affection for him. At the same time, my brother certainly had no aversion to women. There was a great deal that was very admirable in him. He was, you know, for a long time, the only Labour peer. My brother did some useful things. They brought in a bill to make incest criminal, which it hadn't been. And he opposed the bill, and he got some modifications made in it. He was an enlightened person.
Bertrand Russell's brother, far from showing an aversion to women, went through a form of marriage with one woman in America, without first having taken the precaution of obtaining a divorce from his wife, which was valid in England. What followed was a somewhat vindictively prosecuted Edwardian scandal.
He went to Reno and divorced his previous wife in Reno, and after having divorced her, he married in Reno, and according to English law, that was bigamy. Edward VII said this man must be sent to jail for bigamy, because I want to prove I'm a virtuous man. And it was considered a very convincing proof. He was tried by his peers, which also has been abolished because the Russell family abused the privilege. He was tried by his peers, and so was Lord de Clifford, who is also a Russell. And they thought, this is too much, we'll abolish it. I wasn't sent to school. I was educated by tutors. So I didn't have a conventional education. I think the conventional education at public schools was extremely narrow, because the essence of a public school education was to enable you to administer a world inhabited by savages or underlings of some kind. And it no doubt gave you the air of command that enabled you to put your thing through, but it didn't enable you to have the knowledge that would have made what you were trying to put through be right.
Bertrand Russell spent his early childhood in the house of his paternal grandmother.
We had a large house in Richmond Park, and we had 8 servants. There was my grandmother and her unmarried daughter, and my brother and me, and 8 servants to look after us. And so on the whole, the servants had a pretty easy time of it. They didn't have to work very hard, and everybody was contented, and all went well. But it was, of course, very much more comfortable, and certainly the life of upper and middle-class women is far less comfortable than it was then, far less. I think our maids had quite a good time, but a great many had a very bad time, and of course they were never allowed followers.
The Russells were not what is called well-connected. They were the kind of people to whom the well-connected are connected. And so young Bertrand Russell had the opportunity, as a matter of course, of meeting everyone of official consequence in the country. There was, for example, the influential, controversial Master of Balliol, Benjamin Jowett.
Benjamin Jowett, the Master of Balliol, was known to my parents, who didn't like him, and was known to my grandparents, who also had their reservations about him. They thought he was rather frivolous. Somebody asked him once, could you sign the 39 articles? And he said, yes, if you'll give me a pen. And that rather shocked my grandparents. They thought it frivolous. And indeed he was rather. He used to tell undergraduates, he always talked in a very squeaky voice. He used to tell undergraduates, it's necessary to be pushing, but fatal to seem so. And the undergraduates all took this to heart. And that didn't seem very lofty either. Once, when I was adolescent, I suffered from adolescent melancholy, as is not uncommon at that period, and I believed it to be completely genuine, and I thought that I was all the time on the verge of suicide. I wasn't really, but that's what I thought I was. And I dreamt that I was on my deathbed, and Jowett was watching by my deathbed. And in my dream, I said to him in a very die-away sentimental voice, well, at any rate, there's one comfort. I shall soon be out of all this. And Jowett said, do you mean life? And I said, yes, I mean life. And Jowett said, when you're a little older, you won't talk that sort of nonsense. And I never talk that sort of nonsense again.
But for Bertrand Russell, life really began at Cambridge in the 1890s.
I found Cambridge quite delightful, unbelievably delightful. And I really began to live when I went up there. They don't live as comfortably while they are at Cambridge as they used to in my day. There'd be two people in a room, when in my day there would be only one. And they're not allowed to have food in their rooms. They have to go to hall for their food. Whereas in my day you could order anything you liked from the kitchens and have parties in your room, dinner or whatnot. Breakfast, except on Sundays, one generally had alone. The kitchens sent out a breakfast. But on Sundays we had a different plan. We always had a very late breakfast on Sunday, and very large, and we ate enormously, and then we went for a long, long walk in the country, came back just in time for dinner. And that was, I don't say everybody did that, but all my friends did. And that was Sunday ritual. Saturdays we stayed up very late, discussing, arguing, and walking up and down the cloisters and arguing. And those arguments were quite delightful. They had that sort of freshness of youth exploring the world that you can only get in youth. And we used to keep them up till any hour, and that's why we breakfasted so late on Sundays. The cleverer young men in my day, they mostly came from public schools. They knew perfectly well that down to the day of their death they were fairly secure financially. They would go into the civil service, or they would become dons or something or other like that, and their livelihood was safe and they didn't bother. And it gave them a sort of disinterestedness that you can't get in a more straitened atmosphere. The people that I knew best were not rebels. They were mostly in favour of all sorts of reforms, but they were not rebels. They were not outside. I belong to that old world, though I've been forced into becoming more or less of a rebel, but against my temperament and upbringing and so forth. It's not my instinctive line. The young men of my day were not temperamentally cynical. Some of them, of course, had cynical opinions, but I don't think they had cynical feelings. It's quite a different thing. They all felt here is a great tradition which has existed for a long time. Cambridge had a long tradition of great men, and they thought, well, after all, we're inheriting this, we're carrying it on. And they were part of history. But I should think that some of the things that were to me delightful when I was at Cambridge are probably no longer there, because I think that people are more professional, they're more occupied with their career, and less certain of whether they can make a good career. My friends and I did, in fact, spend an enormous amount of time on the acquisition of knowledge, but a great deal of it was knowledge that was not going to be useful in examinations, that we acquired because we liked it. And I should doubt whether there's time for that nowadays.
But behind the combative energy, there seems to have been a sense of isolation.
Well, I did become a bit of a dandy because I was so very, very shy. And I thought, now if I'm absolutely faultlessly dressed, so that nobody can possibly find fault with me, I shall perhaps feel less shy. And I took to dressing as well as I could. I had a beautiful frock coat and lovely socks and a cane with a silver top and all the sort of things that one should have. It didn't last very long, but for a year or two I had them with that.
One of the more interesting byproducts of academic privilege and leisure, and one that is wholly foreign to educational mass production, is the eccentric. In respect of eccentrics, Cambridge was at this time richly endowed.
Eccentrics, they're a natural result of security of tenure. Once you wear it on, there you were, and only something very extreme would get you turned out. And even things that you might think nowadays would be extreme. I knew a Don. He was a charming fellow. I liked him very much indeed. But he had one very peculiar mania. If anybody sneezed in his presence, he thought that person was making fun of him. And he then tried to murder that person. And he would put the poker in the fire, and when it was red hot, he would run after the person who'd sneezed. But as he had a game leg, he could only move very slowly, and no harm came to anybody, and so nobody thought of doing anything about it. But it was quite an adventure going to tea with him. Sidgwick, yes, Sidgwick was one of my teachers of philosophy. He was a very, very high-minded man. He used to stutter, but he always stuttered in a way that was very effective. Some German was talking to him and said, you English have no word for gelehrte. And Sidgwick said, yes, we have. We call them prigs. And Granville Barker was doing one of Gilbert Murray's translations of Euripides, and he came to Cambridge to find out what a Mycenaean hut was like, and he went first to Verrall, who was a very eminent classical scholar, and he said, what was a Mycenaean hut like? And Verrall said, nobody knows, but Jane Harrison will tell you. It was determined to make a new street, and in order to make this street, part of Jeb's garden had to be cut off. Jeb was a member of Parliament for Cambridge, for the university.
Yes.
And it was voted that part should be cut off, and Jeb didn't like it at all. However, he might just have endured that, only it was decided the street should be called Sidgwick Avenue. And that was too much for Jeb. He couldn't bear it. And so there was great coolness between them. And Sidgwick was purported to have said of Jeb, all the time that he can spare from the adornment of his person, he devotes to the neglect of his duties.
Distance and time are sometimes capable of lending additional stature to a reputation. And I asked Lord Russell whether the great men of his youth appeared great at the time. On the whole, the answer seems to have been yes.
They had more of an aura. I think people, when I was young, had more of the aura of a personage. Now, I knew both Tennyson and Browning quite well, and certainly if either of them came into the room, you would think, here's a personage, especially Tennyson. He always wore a sort of Italian opera cloak when he was out of doors, and he walked along in complete absorption and took care not to see you if you were there, because he was so absorbed in poetic meditation. He was rather a fraud. I thought him a humbug. Browning was not. Browning was much more ordinary in a way. My first encounter with Browning was when I was 2 years old. He came to lunch with my people, and he talked the whole time without stopping in a very harsh voice. And at last I, being 2 years old, said, I wish that man would stop talking. And everybody else was feeling the same thing, but of course they had to say, hush, hush. Oh, he was very well groomed, very neat, very tidy. The sort of man who would be pleasant to old ladies. There's a picture of him by Max Beerbohm, visiting the Mee Society at Cambridge, or something like that, and it gets him very right, with a beautiful top hat upside down beside his chair, very glossy and very smooth. And yes, he was very much a man to be an old lady's darling. Tennyson was portentous and tremendous, and sort of... Oh, I don't know. No, I didn't like Tennyson. He was altogether too conscious of himself as a great man. I remember a story that I was told about him when I was young. He'd been going to visit in some country house, and he'd said that above all he did not want to have people coming to see him. He wanted to have quiet time there. And so they took enormous pains to tell all the neighbourhood not to call. And towards the end of the second day, he said, "Nobody seems to want to see me." I don't think he was exactly liked, but he was immensely admired. The Master of Trinity, it was when I was an undergraduate, and they always used to say a Latin grace, and the Master and the Vice Master spoke alternate verses. And the Master spoke in the Continental pronunciation, and the Vice Master in the old English pronunciation. The Master always spoke in a very sentimental way, and he would say, "Per Christum Dominum Nostrum," and the Vice Master would say, "Per Christum Dominum Nostrum," and the contrast was extraordinary. I don't know what they thought of each other. That was a secret locked in their bosoms. The Vice Master never was seen out of doors without his top hat. Once there was a fire at 3 in the morning, and sure enough he turned up in his topper. He didn't think well of Tennyson. The college had some port dating from 1834, and they were very proud of this. And when Tennyson came to visit and was to dine in hall, they produced the 34 port in honour of Tennyson, and he put water in it. And after that, the Vice Master never read a line of his verse. In old days, when you got a fellowship, you got it for life. And the result was that you never died. And when I came up, there was just one left of these life fellows. He was the senior fellow. And he'd got a fellowship when he was 22, and he'd never done a stroke of work since, never. And there he was. And when I came back to college 20 years later, there he was, still going strong and not looking a day older. He was the last survival of an older period. Gladstone's eye. And those who've never seen Gladstone's eye can't understand his place in history. It depended entirely upon a terrifying glance that he used to give people, and you wanted to sink through the earth. I had it in the most terrifying form, far worse than Arthur Balfour can ever have had it, because Mr. Gladstone came to stay with my people, and I was the only male, and after dinner, when the ladies retired, I was left tête-à-tête with Mr. Gladstone. I was only 17, and very, very shy, and it was far the worst experience of my life. Nothing since has terrified me. I was seared to terror forever. He said only one thing. He said, "This is very good port they've given me, but why have they given it me in a claret glass?" And I didn't know the answer. He was frightening beyond all belief. Now, I had a grandmother who was terrifying, in the sort of way that great ladies were in those days. Absolutely terrifying. And I'd seen her make footmen weep. And altogether she was quite frightful. And one day Mr. Gladstone was coming to tea, and she told us beforehand all she was going to say to Mr. Gladstone, telling him off about his Irish policy, which he didn't approve of. And I was there throughout the whole of his visit, and she was as mild and gentle as you could possibly be, and not one word did she say of what she told us she was going to say. It's one of the things about him. The people who knew him called him Mr. Gladstone, and the people who didn't know him called him Gladstone. But all of us who knew him always called him Mr. Gladstone. I remember that he first went into Parliament to uphold slavery. In 1832, when it was a question of slavery in Jamaica, his father owned a lot of slaves in Jamaica, and one of his purposes in going into Parliament was to preserve slavery in Jamaica. He enumerates all his purposes, and at the same time he can't quite persuade himself that he was justified in Sunday travelling in order to get into Parliament. There's a story of Parnell. One of his followers came up to him and wanted to make some move in the House, and Parnell turned to another man and said, "You know, he's not afraid of Gladstone. He thinks he can get the better of him." "I don't think that. I can't get the better of him." And that was Parnell. Gladstone is a public speaker. Had the most amazing, complicated syntax, which I think no man living now could keep in his head extempore as Mr. Gladstone did. That's the story of the drunken man. The Tories at a great meeting that he was going to address had managed to smuggle a drunken man into the front row to interrupt the meeting, and the drunken man did his very utmost to spoil Mr. Gladstone's oration. And at last Mr. Gladstone turned upon him and said, "May I request that gentleman, who has not once but repeatedly interrupted the flow of my observations, to extend to me that large measure of courtesy which, were I in his place and he in mine, I should undoubtedly extend to him." And the drunken man didn't utter another word. The handling of words that existed and is now lost was due to being brought up on Cicero. They all got Ciceronian syntax in their heads, and it was so much in their heads that they could bring it out extempore in the way that we can't now. Yeah. But whether it was worthwhile to have Ciceronian syntax and not understand the modern world is another question. Who had most influence on me in my youth is a very difficult question. I had, of course, influence through books and direct influence through personal contact. Mill and Shelley were the people who influenced me through books. And I don't think I was very much influenced by personal contacts until I went to Cambridge. I didn't come across anybody who thought sufficiently like me to be worthwhile talking to them.
But there seems to have been one young man at Cambridge, extraordinary both in personality and talents, of whom Bertrand Russell took special notice. His name was Lytton Strachey.
I first knew his mother, Lady Strachey. I was on a committee for Votes for Women, and she was on it too. And she was a very remarkable woman. She was very keen on good prose, and she used to read South's sermons to her children to improve their prose. Not for the sentiments he expressed, but for the rhythm of his sentences. And they were all brought up on a great admiration for good prose. And I only knew her for some years, none of the rest of the family. And then one day she asked me to come to dinner, and I came to dinner. Her husband was much older than she was. He was a very old man, an Anglo-Indian. And as the evening went on, perpetually new people came in at the door, and I saw they were new because the old ones were still there. But otherwise I shouldn't have known that it was a new one. They were all so much alike. And as they got younger, they got odder. The oldest son was a perfectly respectable fellow in the War Office, and just like anybody else. But they got gradually odder and odder and odder. Lytton was the last but one, not the oddest. James was the youngest, and he was the oddest. And I began to think I was mad when perpetually fresh things appeared in the doorway. It was extraordinary. Well, then, of course, I knew Lytton very well at Cambridge. He was a good deal younger than me, but I did know him quite well there. And I used to have him to stay with me in the country. He was a funny fellow. Somebody said in his presence they thought young people were interested in human nature. No, were interested in life. And he said, I can't believe they think about life. There's nothing in it. He's always saying things like that. We were talking about what he liked in literature, and he said he didn't like this, and he didn't like that, and he didn't like the other. And so at last I said to him, well, Lyddon, what is it you like in literature? And he said, passion. But Lyddon, now let me see what more I can tell you about him. There was a phase when he dressed oddly. He dressed quite extraordinarily. And he was on a walking tour, and he came to a village, and there was somebody who was put in the sign bed and breakfast, you know. So he went and said, could he sleep there for the night? And I met this good woman afterwards, and she said, at first I thought he was a tramp. But then I looked again, and I saw he was a gentleman, but a very odd one. When I was in prison, and I was reading his Eminent Victorians, and I came upon a passage that made me burst out laughing very loud, and the governor sent a warder round to say, I must kindly remember that prison is a place of punishment, and I mustn't be so cheerful. You had no prison labour to do. You were allowed your own clothes, you were allowed your own food. And mind you, at a time when everybody else was rationed, I alone was not.
Why?
Why? Because they hadn't thought of extending rationing to this very tiny group of First Division prisoners.
That reference to prison opens up a view of another sphere of Lord Russell's activities, a more serious one to him, and one marked by the vigour and uncompromising aim with which he implements in action his political and philosophical convictions, however disagreeable or even hazardous the consequences to himself may prove. Early in the First World War, he was arrested and imprisoned for his energetic opposition to the prosecution of the war by the Liberal government.
I was against the 1914 war, but I was in favour of the Second War. I thought that the Kaiser was not much worse than other people, but I did think that Hitler was a monster and that he had to be fought. My opposition to the First War began as soon as it appeared likely that there would be such a war. As soon as it appeared that we had the Entente with France with a view to fighting Germany, and Germany had an increasing navy with a view to fighting us, and there began to be a war situation somewhere about 1905. And I was very much against it. I thought the Liberals were less likely to go to war with Germany than the Conservatives, and on that ground I supported the Liberals. And then in 1914 it turned out that a secret cabal in the Cabinet, without the knowledge of the rest of the Cabinet, had been preparing war all the time, and that now war was unavoidable. And it was at that point that I abandoned the Liberal Party and became Labour, because I thought the Liberal Party was evidently no good. However, I was on quite friendly terms with a good many people in the Liberal government, including Asquith. My last friendly encounter with Asquith was the result of the most surprising incident in my whole life. I was walking on a hot summer's day in Oxfordshire along the banks of a small river, and I got so warm that I thought I would go in and bathe, and I went in and bathed. The place seemed completely lonely, and I bathed without a costume. When I came out, who should I find standing on the bank but the Prime Minister? A great surprise to me. It was no occasion for dignity or for serious discussion of great political problems. I put on my clothes as quickly as I could while he conversed in an amiable manner, and that was the last time that I had a friendly, comfortable relation with Mr. Asquith. Well, Asquith was, of course, he was a very clever man in the lawyer's type of cleverness. By which I mean that I don't think he was very good at finding out what was right, but he was very good at making out a case for whatever he wanted to make out a case for. Very good. He was a bit loose, no doubt, in his ways of going on. I remember the story of Lilla McCarthy, the actress, you know, dining at Downing Street, and he got a bit drunk, and he had to get up for something, and as he passed behind her, she being, of course, in evening dress, he kissed her on her bare skin, and she said, "Mr. Asquith, is that an insult, or is it homage to a great actress?" And he said, "It's homage." So then she was reconciled. And of course he was a much more tolerant man than Lloyd George. I couldn't deal with Lloyd George. The First World War was a sheer power competition, and rather less disguised than it is now. The Germans wanted a navy that could be as good as the British Navy. The British government made a very great mistake. It invited the Kaiser to a naval review at Spithead, and it was hoped the Kaiser would think, these people are very powerful. But what the Kaiser did think was, I must have a navy as good as Grandmama's. And he set to work to get it. And that was the main cause of the First World War. I don't believe the First War need have taken place at all. And I find that is now the general view among historians. The general view is that it happened by mistake, and partly because everybody was in a hurry. The diplomats were trying to arrange some kind of compromise at the same time that the armies were mobilizing, and each side felt, oh, we can't delay because of mobilization, and so the diplomats didn't get to look in properly. But I think if there'd been more time, the diplomats would have arrived at a compromise solution. I think the First Great War marked the beginning of an epoch of disaster. Whether that disaster is going to be utter and complete and leave the globe without any human beings living in it, we don't yet know. But it certainly ushered in a dreadful period, a far worse period, well, certainly than anything since the Mongols. A horrible period, which we're right in the middle of now, and I don't know whether we're going to be allowed to come out of it, or whether we're all going to be exterminated to please certain people's love of power.
These words bring us to the threshold of a subject unavoidable today in any prolonged conversation with Lord Russell. Unavoidable because his attention is almost exclusively dedicated to it. The danger of the total extermination of human life by nuclear warfare, and the means by which this threat may be averted.
My view is that the arguments for British neutrality are entirely convincing. In fact, I've said, and I believe, that if I could talk to Macmillan for a week, he would come round. Because I could then present the arguments, which I don't suppose he's ever heard, but I'm sure he hasn't. And as I can't get hold of Macmillan, I go round the country speaking and writing, distributing leaflets and that sort of thing, and hope in time to create a great mass movement of self-preservation, which would be politically irresistible. I think it's a very doubtful thing indeed whether it can be done, but I don't see anything else I can do.
Do you think it's as serious as that? It's a matter of preservation?
It's a question whether At the end of the present century, there shall be one single Briton alive in the world. And it's very doubtful whether there will be, very doubtful. And I think everybody who doesn't have some kind of profound self-interest against that view, who's looked into the matter, agrees with me.
Well, how do you account for the scientists who have been advising Macmillan not having told him enough to equip him with what you call your point of view?
Because they get the sack.
Who from?
From Macmillan.
He's not an Oriental tyrant. He must be interested in hearing all...
Oh, I don't think that's true. Now, I was reading C.P. Snow on the Battle of Britain. Well, the man who won the Battle of Britain was sacked by Churchill, who took up with Lord Chauvel, who is just one of these ruffians who do exactly what I say. He told Churchill what Churchill wanted, and the man who'd won the Battle of Britain was sacked. Well, I mean, it's no use, you know, to believe in fairy tales about the virtue of politicians. And although you say that you disapprove of politicians, you in fact have a sort of fairy tale view of their virtue.
No, I haven't got a fairy tale view of their virtue, but neither have an entirely demonic view of their vices. They're human beings, and very often perhaps human beings are more vain initially, or they wouldn't be politicians, and their vanity is fed by the temptations and opportunities of politics. But I don't think they're monsters, and I think amongst them there are those who have a very high moral sense, some of them.
Yes, maybe some, but they seldom become Prime Minister.
I asked him, if he were Prime Minister, what would he do?
If I were Prime Minister tomorrow, I should get England out of NATO. I should make the Americans abandon their bases in Britain. I should have Britain have no independent nuclear weapons. And I should form a league of neutrals. Not, I think, all neutrals, perhaps, but those who are more or less politically mature. There are several of them, Sweden and India and Switzerland, so on. They're quite politically mature. And I should get them, perhaps not formally, but in fact, together, to draw up what they would consider a fair and impartial scheme for general disarmament, and put this out. I think Khrushchev would support it, and America would wish to oppose it. But if Khrushchev and all the neutrals supported it, it would be very, very difficult for America to hold out. At the time of Camp David, it looked as if everything was going smoothly. And I think that the armament industry in America was afraid that the president was escaping from them. And they manufactured this incident in order to recapture the president. And he was a silly man. I mean, everybody agrees that Eisenhower was a silly man. How he ever got his place, I don't know. The answer to the difficulty that each side thinks only the other side ought to give way is that neutrals should be allowed to draw up schemes which they should offer to both sides, and that these schemes should be very carefully framed so as to give no net advantage to either party. And I think that if East and West come adequately to realize how awful a war would be, they may come to allow the neutrals to offer solutions, and I think there'd be a much better chance of their being accepted, because accepting a neutral proposal does not mean yielding to the other side, and I think it's only through neutrals that the deadlock will be solved. Now, I've got to go and address a youth group at Birmingham on Saturday. And I shall say to these young men, now look here, I suppose you realise that if the great powers preserve their present policies, not one of you will be allowed to grow up to his natural span of life. I think unless the policies of the great powers are changed, it's unlikely that there will be human beings at the end of the present century. England can't play a useful part except as a neutral. You wouldn't believe how many Americans think that it would be better to have the human race obliterated than to have communist domination. And I have to admit that in a peaceable world, I think it's quite possible the communists might, by ordinary political propaganda, win control. It's quite possible. I don't on the whole think they would, but they very well might. But I think it would be better to have that than have nobody, because I think most of the faults of communists come from fear, and if they had no reason for fear, they would soon become much milder.
Some of the so-called faults of the communists are Russian qualities rather than communist qualities.
Oh, of course, the communists are there. I've often said in print that if Russia was still Tsarist, the situation would be exactly what it is, not different one iota. There is no newspaper that agrees with me, as far as I know. No important newspaper agrees with me. They go with Gateskill. Well, the Guardian is no good at all nowadays. You'll see a letter from me to the Guardian in that edition there, protesting against their leaders. Oh no, the Guardian's very bad. The Guardian is worse than the Times. The Times is fairly good, considering it is the Times.
Yes.
You see, a newspaper will print a very short letter from me. It won't print a long one. And in a short letter, I can't set it out. And the newspapers are determined that the public shall not know what we stand for. I think it's all respect for British prestige. They can't bear admitting how unimportant England is nowadays from a purely military point of view. That's their pride. I think we could still be important diplomatically and morally, but we're not important militarily.
He spoke of how the movement for unilateral disarmament began.
A broadcast I did in at Christmas 1954 or 53, I forget which I called Man's Peril. Mm-hmm. And that started the movement everywhere. That was the beginning. Immediately after that, I got a collection of scientists of both East and West to sign a joint document, which was the last act of Einstein's life to sign it. I was travelling from Rome to Paris by air, and the pilot came in and announced to the passengers that Einstein was dead. And when I got to Paris, I found Einstein's letter agreeing to sign. And that started a whole movement among scientists, which has gone on and been very strong. It's stronger in America than it is here, a great deal. The American scientists are much better than ours. Well, I mean, there are a much larger percentage of them who are willing to sign things and so on, expressing our sort of policy. I find it difficult not to get a little fanatical because the issue is so large. It's the largest there's been since Noah.
And we have no ark.
No, we have no ark, no. I had thought of bringing a bill into the House of Lords that we should at all times, while nuclear things are so unsettled, have a ship in the Antarctic with at least one woman on board of childbearing age, and of course a clergyman of the Church of England to marry her to whoever she wished to marry. You see, there's quite a chance that the Antarctic will be more or less free from fallout. And if you had a population in the Antarctic, it might start again. But I couldn't quite see their lordships accepting the bill.
Hmm.